very welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast, and about as busy an RTE Rugby Podcast as we could possibly be doing this season. It is 10 a.m. on a Wednesday morning, and to say we've had a boatload of news in the last hour and a half is an understatement. Rico Ioane to join Leinster from next season. And if that wasn't enough, just before 9 a.m, Pete Wilkins officially resigning from his role as head coach at Connacht was also confirmed as well. Later on in the show, Hannah O'Connor will be back with us for a Women's Six Nations recap. But for now, Bernard Jackman is with me, and so is Johnny Murphy from an interesting location. Tell everyone where you are, Johnny, this morning.
I'm in the sales ring in Tattersall, so I've been here the last 2 days, just at the Craven Breeze Up sale. So busy couple of days, but not sure whether you can see it. So nice to do it here while it's quiet. So hopefully I don't get kicked out before the end of it.
So you're off buying horses, Bernard. You're on your way to buy cattle this morning.
Yeah, no, I'm on my way to Castle Island. I pulled in at Castle Troy. Must be something in Newbridge College. But Johnny's in the richer sport.
I wouldn't say that.
We won't talk about cattle or horses. We'll talk about Rico Ioane and all matters rugby.
We'll talk about thoroughbreds, Rico Ioane and Johnny Barrett today. Right, so let's get into it. I mean, I was kind of, I'll say, arsing around this morning just after 8 o'clock, sipping my cup of coffee before logging on to work and get prepped for the podcast. And I see a tweet or a post on X from the Blues saying, Rico Ioane is taking up his sabbatical to join Leinster next season. And I absolutely had to double check that this wasn't a post from April Fool's Day that had just got kind of pushed up in the algorithm by X to this afternoon. I'd say three or four times I had to double check that this was the actual Blues X account that I was looking at. I cross-referenced it with Instagram where they had another post. And just to make sure, because Leinster hadn't even announced it, I had to send Marcus Abukala, the Leinster communications man, a text just to say, this is legit, isn't it? And he confirmed it. What a shock to wake up to on a Wednesday morning, Bernard.
Yeah, great signing. And probably it's going to cause a lot of debate on social media among the other fans, because in the other provinces, because they kind of thought that they'd got one up on Leinster yesterday with the new central contracts, funding model, etc. And a sign that there was going to be more quality in Irish rugby in terms of who has what. But another serious flex from Leinster when, you know, they've just gone, whatever, two games in a row with incredible performances on the field where they look to be a different level. And we all knew Jordy Barrett was going back, and then to be able to sign, you know, another All Black who's also in the peak of his powers in terms of age profile. It's another sabbatical deal. And yeah, big world star. It's a big marketing coup, but it's also, he's a player who I think will give them something different, very different than Barrett. You know, Barrett is kind of the all-around player, whereas I would say Ioane is power, pace, you know, kind of X factor. Who wouldn't want someone like him in their team? I was only talking to someone the other day about the quality of non-Irish foreign players across the Premiership and the URC, take away South Africa, the home URC nations. Mm-hmm. And realistically, like, there's no one like Barrett or RG Snyman of that quality. And now they Leinster go and pull another one. You know, they pull another one. So it's they'll be absolutely delighted with the recruitment. Guy Easterby will be chuffed. And it's a serious statement because, like, I think Leinster are on track to win Europe and maybe the double. And they're not going to get any weaker with someone like him coming.
And Johnny, like, it isn't a shock in the sense that Leinster are signing a massive player, because we saw it last year. Obviously, there was the Jordy Barrett thing and Orgie Snyman and Slimani. And I think we've kind of accepted the fact that when Leinster are going to be going after their foreign signings now, they are going to be going after the marquee players rather than taking the cheaper options. But it's just the fact as well that it's Rico Ioane, the man who has all this history with Johnny Sexton from the World Cup and, you know, playing up to the Irish fans at the Aviva Stadium last year, like, essentially public enemy number one from an Irish rugby standpoint. Like, this is an incredible plot twist.
Yeah, he's like he was the pantomime villain, coming up to Christmas, and yeah, to be able to sign someone of his quality is just brilliant. It's incredible for Leinster, for their fans. But like someone like him with his quality, when he'll get into the environment, he'll be unbelievable. And like all of that adds to it. It adds to, I suppose, nearly for the want of a better word, the trolling that Leinster are doing towards nearly the RFU and the other fans. Like the timing of it, the day after the release yesterday from the RFU. Yeah, it's just another one where they do, as Bert said, they just flex their muscles. But a brilliant signing, and something that will galvanize, even though he'll come in with that kind of chip on his shoulder from a fan's perspective, that he's going to come and make a massive difference.
The scary thing as well, Bernard, is you go from Jordy Barrett onto Rico Ioane. Now, if Rico comes next season and does really, really well again and, lives up to what Jordy Barrett is kind of doing this season, are we getting to a point then when the sabbaticals are a fairly common thing for the All Black Stars? Are we getting to a point then when word starts going around the changing room is that, you know what? Never mind Japan. Leinster's the place to go to spend your 6 months, because you get to play in one of the best club teams in the world. Maybe you're not getting Japan money, but you're getting fairly well paid. Word of mouth, I imagine, is a very important thing when it comes to recruitment in professional rugby.
No, 100%, and also just that relationship with the NZRU. Where there's that trust. You look after Rico Ioane well. You've looked after Jordy Barrett well. They know they don't need to
To
be.
keep minding them.
Yeah, they're minded here. It's a good environment here. Japan. The benefit of Japan is obviously the fact they play so few games, but there's all lots of stories of incredibly intense. And long training sessions over there. It's certainly it wouldn't be unheard of to have 3.5 hour, 4 hour training sessions on their feet. So that's something that, from a performance point of view, you wouldn't really want your players to be exposed. If I know the box tend to go to Japan and it doesn't affect them, but just in general, the load management would be a lot better over here. Or sorry, more aligned to what New Zealand would see as the best way to look after players. So I think that's it. The trust of being able to go and negotiate with the NZRU. And the more you do it, and the fact if the players enjoy it, which I think Barrett obviously has, hopefully Rico will, and then it could be something that happens on a regular basis. But I would say this shouldn't just be exclusive to Leinster. This should be what the other four provinces, if they have the financial power, should be able to do. Because the beauty of a sabbatical or a 6 month or 7 month deal is effectively, like, what's the point paying Jordy Barrett for preseason? What's the point paying him for September, October? So if you can really ramp up the quality of player you bring in terms of a world star, obviously from a off the field point of view, that's great. Kids, fans can go see someone play in the green of Connacht who's a current All Black or Springbok or Wallaby. But also because if you're short on money, well, just pay him 12 months over 7 months, if you get me. Rather than having because those really top quality players, they don't need to be in an environment for that long. They're used to jumping, into Test rugby from Super Rugby, and I think they can adapt very easily. So I would say that it's brilliant Leinster are showing the way in this, but I would love a Will Jordan to be going to Connacht or Munster or Ulster for 6 or 7 months either. And don't forget, the NZRU want this. They like the sabbatical because it saves them money. It saves them money over the course of their 4 year cycles, and keeps the best players available to New Zealand. So yeah, hopefully this can be start of something that is the Leinster obviously are leading the way in, but it can go to the other provinces. And obviously the funding model yesterday, the changes that we're seeing in that. I'm going to jump forward here, Neil, in terms of that 40% of the central contracts now have to be paid by the province. I think the press release says that that money that's saved has been earmarked for player development. But again, I would love to see if funds can be found to just try and give the other provinces a lift. Now, player development is really important. But realistically, the other provinces aren't going to see any benefits to that for 4 or 5 years in terms of, in terms of Richie Murphy being able to win a European Cup game away to Bordeaux. It's probably going to be 4 or 5 years before the new funding and the player development changes or investment helps. But like, that's a long time in pro sport. So again, I'm really fascinated to see what else David Humphreys is going to bring in to help the other provinces.
The only thing on that, Bert, is that Leinster, from a all high level sports people across all, they're all competitors. They want to win, and I think that's what Leinster probably have up on the other provinces, in the sense at the moment that people like Rico Ianni can come here and he can be like, well, I can win a European Cup. Like, they have the squad that on paper is going to be in a not just a semi-final, but a final more or less every year. And that's the chance for me to get a medal that not a lot of people, that a select few in the Southern Hemisphere have. And I think that's what they're combining at the moment, because everyone at the highest level of any sport, they want to win. And the opportunity to leave, come up here, enjoy something new, and win something that has a huge amount of kudos or notoriety. Where Japan, yes, look, you get extremely well paid, but does a Japan league have the notoriety of a European Cup? And I think that's also something that needs to, where someone going to Munster, there's a history there between all the All Blacks and New Zealanders that have been, and you look at it and go, well, Munster are can be a semi-final side, on paper. Are they going to win a European Cup? They're not this year, but are they next year? Maybe not. And Birch alludes to Birch's thing, 3, 4 years down the line, how great would it be to see all these high-end New Zealand players that come in and give it what the likes of, Rua, Te Pauki, what Dougie, all those guys that have been there before, like Brad Thorne, all those guys. And, they all have medals in their pockets. Not a lot of There's not a lot of those medals down there.
I do wonder, is Ian Costello getting onto Clayton McMillan saying, and any idea, does Damian McKenzie have any sabbaticals coming up in his contract? I know they've Jack Crowley already, but I mean, you can put McKenzie in at fullback or something like that. That is an important point though, Johnny, about like the attractiveness of Leinster, that it's you're coming over and you're instantly going into a title challenging team, and you're giving yourself the opportunity to win one of giving yourself an opportunity to win one of the biggest competitions in club rugby. And the other part of it then as well is, and we like Bernard, you mentioned that you're very well looked after in terms of welfare and stuff, and you're not going to be flogged week on week on week. And I think the way the URC is structured, where they have the break weeks during the Six Nations, fits in nicely into that as well, because a player's coming over on a short stint from December through to the end of the season. And they know that during February and March, they actually get a couple of weeks off. Jordy Barrett's been able to go around the country playing golf, enjoying himself, sightseeing, travel around Europe a little bit.
He was in the
There's.
Maldives or somewhere as well. He was down somewhere.
Yeah, he's
Yeah,
having the
like,
time of his life.
yeah, no, it's great. But like, that's what, I agree with Johnny, that Leinster for those players is very attractive at the moment, because also you're also following on now from, what RG and what Geordie has done. You're living in the capital city. You're not going to get overplayed because there's pressure to play the Irish players. But I still think, McMillan for sure has contacts there. I wonder. Someone t sent me a message yesterday asking me who Munster's foreign or marquee sign is going to be, and I haven't heard anything. But I'd love to see them go out and make a big statement. I know it's tough at the moment financially, but I just think it gives everybody a lift. I mean, it gives everybody. You're in the Leinster Academy this morning, our sub academy, and next year if you go well, you're going to be training or potentially playing with another superstar. I mean, that's massive. Fans, Leinster fans this morning will have a pep in their step. It also increased their chance of winning, let's be honest. It increased their chance of winning because when it gets to the knockout stages of these big games, that type of player, they make a big difference. They make a big difference. So it's really interesting. Leinster's flip on what they used to want, what they thought was the way forward, and obviously not winning has led to that, and I admire that, because They just need to get over the line. They need to get over the line and consistently get over the line. And their retention and recruitment is geared up towards that.
From a rugby point of view, then, in terms of Rico Ioane, the player, and what he's bringing to Leinster, Johnny, obviously he's a centre, so in theory, it's broadly the same position as Jordy Barrett, but it's a very, very different kind of centre. He's probably more, if he's taking someone's place in the team, he's probably taking Gary Ringrose's place rather than Robbie Henshaw's place, and his second position would be more wing rather than full back with Barrett. So a similar signing, but a very different signing in a similar sense.
Yeah, well, I think his best position is 13, so he gives you that power and speed at 13. You look at, Barrett's positioning is 12 to 15, where they probably, they've flipped it now for next season, where it could be a situation where Ringrose could be on the bench with Henshaw at 12, or and you've seen it a bit more of late, even with Ireland, where Ringrose shifts out to the wing, with Ioane coming in. That means that could potentially happen less and look more at six twos, where they have the opportunity then to say have someone like Frawley on the bench, and then they can start, so you can manipulate whatever way you want in the back line. So yeah, they've just flipped it where, coming into quarterfinals or semi-finals maybe next year, that it might be a situation where Ringrose is on the bench, or Ioane's on the bench and then he comes on the wing, or they mix and match that way. But yeah, they're good selection headaches to have while Barrett's here, but also looking into next year.
It's really interesting to see how we will fit into that team and that system, like Jack Nienaber's defense, Tyler Blaindell's attack, Bernard, isn't
Yeah, you fine.
Oh, don't worry,
They.
I don't have concerns, just the just actually picturing how
Oh,
it'll
have a
work out
look.
together.
Yeah, look, it gives them a lot of power. You know what I mean? A lot of power, both sides of the ball. Yeah, it's very, he's very different though. He's very different. Like, I think the players have been blown away by Barrett. They have been blown away by Barrett, about everything about him. How easygoing he is, until the
Until he
whistle
doesn't have to
blows.
be easygoing.
Yeah, exactly. When the whistle blows, and just but yeah, the training, how fit he is. His high speed meters is incredible. His durability. He's everything you would expect him to be. But I think Ioane is different. He's kind of got stardust moments, particularly in terms of his carry and power and contact. So, yeah, Leinster have lots of really good players, and he's going to add to it.
Yeah, I'd say there's a lot of Leinster supporters deleting tweets from about 6 months and 18 months ago this morning. That leads us on to Leinster at the weekend against Glasgow Warriors and Jordy Barrett in general. So Leinster 52-0 winners against Glasgow Warriors, following on from 62-0 against Harlequins the week before. 114-0 across the last two games. To book their place in the semi-final, and they are now the absolute favourites for the Investec Champions Cup. On Barrett's performance on Friday night, Johnny, I think pretty much everyone thought Jordy Barrett was going to be a good signing for Leinster. I didn't think he was going to be this good, because I know it was still only a quarter final and it was a thumping and all that, but Glasgow Warriors turned up and actually wanted a game, and Jordy Barrett on Friday night was out of this world good.
Yeah, and it's what he gives you, I think, as an all-round package, was the thing that really struck me watching it on Friday night. His turnovers, he gets credited with three, but in reality it's probably four. It's his work post tackle, all the stuff that coaches use a phrase like talentless tasks. It was all the stuff that requires zero talent and just hard work. And then you look at what he gives the team in attack. He gives someone like Sam an armchair ride because of all the communication that he gives outside him, all the organization that he has in the pods in front of him, popping up at first receiver and then out the back at second receiver and multi-phase. He has absolutely everything, and he's fitted into the systems seamlessly, and I think Friday night was a performance that just showed how good he was. What he adds, like he's a big guy. What he adds defensively and his hits, his work rate off the ball, to get into position, to get forward off the line, and then his work in the contact is he was like an extra back rower. And then when you compare that to someone like Josh van der Fleer over the last, he's like an extra centre playing in the wider channels at the moment. And they just have this incredible balance. But their ability to get the space. Look, Glasgow were pretty depleted in terms of their, the players that they've been missing. But as you say, they did come to play. But the defence has just been astronomical, and they have D leaders across the board, and their attack is really starting to click. Okay, they haven't been up against much last 2 weeks, but yeah, it's it was. It was incredible to watch, and it was really, really enjoyable to see what he brings, both defensively from an attack perspective, but then really interesting to watch what he brings from a D perspective, which he wouldn't have necessarily been, they wouldn't have been shouting from the rooftops all the time.
And Bernard, like we spoke about this last week before the game, and we were talking about the fact that a few years ago Glasgow Warriors came over to Dublin for a URC quarterfinal and got the doors blown off them, and they never even showed up really. They threw in the towel early on, and that was that. And we criticised Harlequins for kind of phoning in a performance in Croke Park the week before. If you look at the scoreline of this game and see 52-0 and Leinster score, what was it, seven or eight tries, you're kind of thinking it's along those same lines. But I can't remember the last time I saw a team try to stand up to Leinster so much and still lose 52-0. Like Franco Smith after the game just kind of came into the press conference, held his hands up. He said he was very, very proud of his team's performance, that they never gave in, but they were just up against, like he said, the best club team in the world.
Yeah, it's very fair. It's a fair summation of what we saw. Like they probably had more big hits against Leinster. They did show good intent, but yes, there was a difference in class. And this is one of the better sides in the URC. It's a side who, would have aspirations around Champions Cup at some stage. So I think they came here and I like with a sense of, oh, we can upset them. I think the problem is that the gulf is very big. When Leinster are on fire, which they are at the moment, like they have absolutely peaked these 2 weeks, in terms of execution, in terms of energy, in terms of game plan. And now they gotta make sure they don't go backwards. They don't go backwards in May. You would like to think that they won't. There seems to be a real unified cause and understanding that they can't underestimate any opposition. They just got to get it done. But they are the quality of rugby they played the last 2 weeks, both in attack and defense, is phenomenal. And with what looking at the other quarterfinals, and I know teams will improve as the weather gets better and all that stuff, but there's no one in form at the moment who's within 10 points of them. Like the Toulon Toulouse game was fascinating. There were two evenly matched sides, two teams set up tactically differently, but neither of them were at the intensity that Leinster have brought. And ruthless, like 30 points up, still defending like they're trying to hold on to win by a point. Not just on their own goal line, all areas of the field. There's actually no real shift. There's no real shift. 60 yards out or 10 yards out, they're defending with the same intensity, which isn't common. Which isn't common when you watch rugby games. Teams are a lot softer further up the field. Leinster have no obvious soft edge to their game.
Well, that's a big element of what we've been talking about for a good chunk of this season, was that Leinster's attack wasn't necessarily firing like it used to. And I think the common wisdom would have been that they have to exert so much energy on defence that they're almost kind of using their attack as an opportunity to catch their breath a little bit. And that was the kind of theory doing the rounds at the time. But Johnny, the last couple of weeks have shown that, I don't know, maybe the fitness has improved considerably or something, because they are looking just as aggressive and bullish when they have the ball in their hands now as they do in defence. 114-0 across the last two games. And if you throw in the last half hour of the Sharks game, it's coming up on 190 minutes since they conceded a point. That's 3 hours and 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's absolute madness. I do think that there was going to be an acclimatization towards Liam Barr's defensive structure in terms of what physically the toll that takes on you to be kind of all in all the time and double down on line breaks and keep bringing your energy and then your energy and the contact. But that will also help. You have to condition yourself to be able to do it on both sides, as you say, Neil. And they're just in this prime physical state that when they get a turnover, they can click into that transition really quick. That and there's no drop off in tempo. Maybe last year there was a potential where when they got a turnover, they didn't necessarily have the physical capability to double on and raise their energy levels again when they got the ball back. But you've seen over the last 2.5 games, 3 games, what they did in South Africa, and that's across the whole squad. So that game, I think, and we spoke about it last week, is a real cornerstone of where, what the extras and the guys who are probably, 25 to 40 in the squad, that they have the same capability of doing it as well. And that's what makes them just so scary at the moment, because there's no drop off. And then, selection was rewarded with a few people this weekend, and that's only right. And it gives everyone an opp gives everyone a reminder that you do well, you get a chance. And Max Deegan is a prime example of that.
That's an important point, actually, as well. That they burn it. They put in this performance, and never mind they didn't drop down a level from Harlequins. They probably actually went up a level or two from Harlequins last week, even in spite of making, was it six changes to the team, leaving Caelan Dorris, Andrew Porter, Dan Sheehan, and a few others as well on the bench. And the people who were given their opportunities, like Max Deegan, and I'd say like Tommy O'Brien as well, grabbed their chance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Deegan was excellent. And it was fitting because I thought he led the team really well against the Sharks. And you have to reward that, as hard as it is to manage game time in knockout rugby when you have, players of the quality of Doris, etc., available to you. I thought it was a really good sign that will improve and keep that whole squad morale, that the Dirt Trackers will get rewarded. And him and Tommy O'Brien in particular were excellent. I think Tommy O'Brien has a cracking chance of forcing his way in there. If I was Jimmy O'Brien or Jordan Larmour or Jamie Osborne, I would see him now as a genuine threat to my opportunity to play in the semi-final or the final. He has.
Well, Bernard, like we've been talking about speed since that France game, the out and out speed, and he has out and out speed.
He's out at speed.
And he can whack too, like he can hit people. Like he, you
Yeah.
know, like he's not just quick, like he's powerful, like he can whack lads.
Yeah. No, he has he has something. He has something. He's very competitive. He's a absolute competitor, and that's probably why he's had so many knocks, because he only knows one way, and that's 100 miles an hour. But again, players who played with him and trained with him, they think he's tipped to go a long way. And it's just a very competitive area. Obviously, James Lowe is nailed down, but Tommy O'Brien, if he can stay fit, has a role to play at the end of the season.
Yeah, really, really determined character. I interviewed him before Christmas, when he was just coming back from his latest injury setback, and he was talking about how he only felt that a really bullish and confident guy. You know, he was talking about the fact that he feels that he only, like, if he gets a consistent run of games in a Leinster team, he's good enough to be breaking into an Ireland squad. And he's saying this before he'd even played a game of Champions Cup rugby. He forked out his own money to go over to, I think it was Qatar last summer, off the back of a recommendation from Johnny Sexton to meet a doctor about his ongoing hamstring problems and trying to get that corrected and stuff. So a seriously determined guy. It'll be interesting to see how the rest of his season pans out. We will move on from Leinster because, as I mentioned, we had some other big breaking news just before 9 o'clock this morning. Probably something we had been expecting for a little while, Bernard, but Pete Wilkins has stepped down with immediate effect as head coach of Connacht. The statement in from the province this morning, Wilkins says, "It's with a heavy heart I'm announcing my departure from Connacht Rugby, the club and province that I've been so proud to call home for the last 8 years. During this season, I've been having some very open and honest discussions about my future at the club, although incredibly privileged to have been given the responsibility of leading the rugby program here. The longer I've spent in the role, the further away I've found myself from the aspects of coaching, not only that I most enjoy, but also that allow me to contribute most effectively to the team." So the background, obviously, he had been on sick leave for the last 4 games, so maybe 4 or 5 weeks. Connacht had been without him. Cully Tucker had been leading the management team. He'll be interim coach until the end of the season. So, Bernard, it wasn't necessarily a surprising development, but a disappointing way, I suppose, for things to end for Wilkins at Connacht, because he has given them great service for 8 years and was a top defence coach working under Andy Friend.
Yeah, 8 years, a long time. Obviously, he came from Edinburgh. He was formerly the Queensland Reds. Good coach, good communicator. And I think, to be honest, the last 6 or 7 weeks when he's been missing, and Connacht's performances during that time, I think shows it's all not Pete Wilkins' fault. You know, like the team are no better. I think that probably there hasn't even been a bounce, really. You know, sometimes when there's a new voice, it'll be really interesting how they go on a South African tour. I think for Pete Wilkins, you know, his statement's very clear. Wants to get back, kind of hands-on coaching, unless of the, less
Back
of
in tracksuit.
the track exactly, which he is like highly regarded by the Connacht players there. So, I think from a Connacht point of view now, obviously to firm up what the coaching staff looks like pretty soon. Obviously, Billy Millar's coming back to Galway via, you know, he was in Connacht before, was in Cardiff, was in Harlequins. He's head of performance. Does he now go and decide, you know, what that coaching staff looks like? Does Collie Tucker get a chance to be head coach? Obviously, he's doing it at the moment, and probably the next couple of weeks will have a big say in terms of that. Is it internal or is it external? But you know, it's been a disappointing season for Connacht on the field. Obviously, Racing was a disaster in terms of the opportunity missed, in terms of, you know, being so far ahead, red card for Racing and still lose. So they've got to make sure that next season is better. And getting the right coaching staff and the right organizational structure is going to be absolutely critical for that. So it's tough on Pete, but we know that's pro coaching. And from an Irish province point of view, you know, Munster went out and got Clayton McMillan, which we think is a phenomenal signing. And hopefully Connacht can reorganize in a similar way, that they have a real pep in them step coming back into pre-season, and the players see next season as being a lot better on the field.
You would worry, Johnny, that this has the potential to just write off the season now, because they're struggling in the league. They're down in 13th. I know there isn't a big gap between them and the playoffs, etc. And but the list of games they have, the injuries they've picked up off the back of that Racing game, the fact that it was such a deflating exit in the Challenge Cup, having been in such a strong position, 21-5 ahead against a Racing team that had a red card. Everything about this season just feels deflating now at this stage. And I don't know what you think. I would have fears maybe that this season could just fizzle out entirely.
Yeah, it can. Of course, it can. But I think it, it's over to the players to internally kind of, circle the wagons and get going after something. As you say, they still have something to play for. They have a playoff spot, and I think that's once they have that carrot, they have to try and chase it. I suppose, particularly post Christmas, Saturday evening was very much like what. Their season has been all year. They've been put themselves. They play some brilliant rugby at times, and then they don't control momentum in any way, shape, or form. They let teams back in, and they get back going again. And to be in that position with 14 men, and then to be in the position with 13 men the last whatever 7, 5, 6, 7 minutes to kind of get that score, and then not. Really get after it in the last 90 seconds, 2 minutes. They just kind of lack a small bit of, I don't know whether it's maybe a small bit of leadership on or off the pitch at the moment, and they need to just try and get back together and get doing what they're good at. But there are definitely green shoots there, in terms of performances and snippets in games that they can build on, but they need to try and make sure, as you say, that this season they do have performances that just don't fizzle out, and they try and put those 5, 6, 7 minute blocks, get them to 10 minutes, get them to 12, 15, and try and build their way into the season and hopefully squeak a playoff spot for them, because there is a huge amount to still play for. As difficult as it's going to be, but they do have a shot.
Yeah, that performance against Racing, it was almost as if you took their entire season and bottled it into 180 minutes. It just kind of summed it all up. Bernard, as Johnny said, like the green shoots are, their attack is as sharp as it's ever been. But the problem is, if they're scoring 40 points, the opposition are scoring more than 40 points, inevitably. But would you be concerned that, obviously, with Mark Sexton leaving next season, they might not have that attacking spark, or does that stay with the team after the attack coach has left? Is it as much the players as it is the coach?
No, I think the coach has a big influence on us.
Yeah.
All the players are very positive about Mark's influence. But to be fair, I think you have to give credit to Wilkins in that he embraced that too. And Connacht were set up to be an attacking team. So it does come from the head coach to set your team up that way. I also think, to be fair, they know they don't have the bang to play many other ways. They potentially could be a little bit smarter in their kicking game. But yeah, they have to play that way. And Andy Friend identified that, Pat Lamb identified that. So this isn't that new. But obviously with a new head coach coming in, they may see it differently. Our new head coach will be appointed, they might see it differently. But their attacking game is as good as most. It's good as most in the URC, and better than a lot. But it could go backwards, obviously, with Sexton going to Ulster. I'm fascinated to see how they dig in here now. I'm fascinated to see how they dig in for the rest of the season. It could go pear-shaped very easily. I actually think Jack Carty being back is massive, and it's a massive opportunity for him to finish his Connacht career, in situ or on a high, or at least having moments on the field if it is the end of his Connacht career. And obviously it's injury enforced, but he's been starved of game time. And he's a former Connacht captain. He's a point to prove. And if he can galvanize this group, who for lots of reasons could down tools to actually not and go and get something out of the South African tour, and obviously then they've got a couple difficult games to go. But if they could get something out of the South African tour, even in terms of performance, it would show a lot about their character and their spirit and their fight. So I think the next couple of weeks are going to be very interesting, in terms of what this team are made of.
Yeah, they've got a busy few weeks ahead of them, and the first of those games, as you say, excuse me, away to the Stormers this Saturday afternoon. That's live on RT2 and RT Player. On Munster then. It's rare Munster are so far down on the news agenda, but that's been the kind of morning it has been. Champions Cup campaign over, Bernard, and it's the old failings again. It was the, I know it wasn't just the lineout, but so much of Saturday's 47-29 defeat to Bordeaux comes down to the lineout. Nine lineouts in total lost over the course of the game. I know you were in Cork as well ahead of the Ireland women's game, and I found it fascinating to watch. Just over an hour before the teams were there, an hour just over an hour before kickoff, when the teams were just having a little stroll around the pitch, even before the warm-ups, they were obviously showing the Munster match on the big screen at Virgin Media Park, and Alex Codling was just standing down at the far end of the pitch, right in front of the screen, on his phone at times, probably trying to put out a few fires along the way. It was a tough sight to watch as Munster's season kind of unraveled.
Yeah, just to explain the scenario here. So basically, when Graham Rowntree and Andy Kyriacou left, Munster with help from the IRFU seconded Alex Codling in to help Munster. So the women weren't playing at the time. He had some free time. So he was in situ as the Munster lineup coach. And I think Sean Cronin was his understudy.
And
Obviously,
Tommy O'Donnell as well.
Tommy O'Donnell as well. So the idea was they knew that he would have to go back to the women's when the Six Nations came around. But unfortunately, I think that he's done such a he's sorry he's built he's made such a good impression in Munster. I think they want to continue that relationship. I think he's certainly got the players and the coaches believing in his method. So he on his day off last week and maybe the week before, he was back with Munster putting together a plan. But unfortunately, look, the reason clubs bring coaches to games is they can help problem solve during the game, and things started to go awry very quickly for Munster in the line-out time, and they descended into panic, really. It's probably the easiest way of putting it. But yeah, he obviously couldn't help because he might be able to send a text message or whatever, but it's not high performance, is it? But that's, look, he's contracted to the women's and contracts are important. So it's just what happens next. I also think it's very unfortunate for Munster that they ended up in a situation where they didn't have one of the key. They needed to dominate Bordeaux at the line of time. I mean, when you look at the Bordeaux back line, you need to start them a possession. You can't be losing your own possession. And that wasn't the only part of the game, but it was a significant part. So obviously now the challenge for Ian Costello and Munster Rugby is to make sure this never happens again or doesn't happen for a long time, and that they have their coaching staff fully in place. And I think obviously Clayton McMillan is a forwards coach, but my understanding is that they would love to have Clayton McMillan and Alex Codling as part of their coaching staff next year and the year after and the year after, whatever, long term. The only spanner in the works is that Alex Codling is contracted to the women's for the World Cup, so he would miss pre-season, which again is a great opportunity to really, drive standards, implement systems, etc. And again, can a compromise be found there? I don't know, but that's my understanding of Munster's solution to what was an obvious problem at the weekend is to try and get Alex Codling on a full-time basis.
And look, if they do, obviously it will be a blow for the women's team, but I think there is a fairly easy compromise to be had there if Codling was to stay on through the World Cup. And I know you said obviously like he wouldn't have a pre-season at Munster, but the fact that he's had the involvement with the team since November or so is a solid bit of groundwork to kind of to cover that in a sense as well. But look, we'll find out in due course. Ian Costello said yesterday that they kind of have a forwards coach more or less lined up for next season, but he couldn't give us a name, and it'll be revealed in due course. So, I think we might be hearing a little bit more about Alex Codling's future over the next while. In terms of the rest of the season, there's still, Johnny, so much to play for Munster, starting with the Bulls this weekend. They don't necessarily have an easy run in. Like, they're playing the Bulls, they've got Ulster as well, Cardiff next weekend, and also in the mix is Benetton, who are right around that playoff mix. The injuries are starting to pile up a little bit as well. Jeremy Lochman's pretty much ruled out for the rest of the season. Diarmaid Barron's going to be out for a week or two as well. Calvin Nash and Gavin Coombs probably missing this week. I think John Hodnett also ruled out of this week. But the good news is managed to get Michael Milne and Lee Barron in this week ahead of schedule. They were due to arrive next season, but they're on loan to for the rest of the season. So effectively, they are Munster players from here on in. It's going to be really interesting to see how those two players get on. I'm particularly interested by Milne, who always looked to have something about him when he got the opportunities for Leinster, but he's just, it's just a you're so far down in a depth chart, sometimes it's hard to put your hand up. He's a big, beefy kind of a prop, the kind of prop that Munster haven't had for a while.
Big ball carrier, powerful in the contacts. Will Sue Prendy's very much attack shape. I think so will Barn. They're both really dynamic ball carriers, good ball players. Berts can talk about the scrummaging, but like in terms of that, they're certainly going to add from a physicality and ball carrying perspective. I think it's really important that Munster get something out of this year. Their performance on at the weekend, for me, defensively they got caught out. Kind of, they concede off first phase, as a back line, two first phase tries off scrum where scrum's getting dominated. They get quite tight. Then first try, Abrahams closes the gate really quickly, and I suppose he's potentially worried about speed on the outside to close that gate. But for me, and it happened in three of their of the tries, when they get around them, everyone's hips are towards a touchline, so they don't make those cover tackles. And that's, I think defensively they were just they were off. I personally don't think the referee had a great game for either side. Like, I think their last try, Murray gets taken out. Like, there's a clear, like, in my opinion, you don't play the nine. I don't think they would have won the game, but they might have been within a point. I think Munster's penalty try was a bit, like, it's not like Birdo don't have a speed in the lads who are covering across. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it would have been a very good finish. There was a good, like, look, their try, the Maul try that he said was hold up, and then we went up. That was like, that's just a communication error, but like, he did signal held up first. I don't think that gets the result, puts the result in question. It was just, we said last week that they wanted to bring Bordeaux into an arm wrestle and be quite Munster-esque in how they did build a platform, kick well, defend well. And they just never got an opportunity to, they worked so hard to get themselves back in the game, and then they just, discipline kills them. They're within, I think, within 11 points, and then there's, two yellow cards, 5 minutes. They've an opportunity to get, sorry, 14, to get back in within seven, where you're 5 minutes. They're like, all right, here we go. Now's the chance. And they end that 5 minute period with two yellow cards of their own, and they're like 18 points, or they're nearly out of sight. But I think it's really important that Munster, for the lads that are leaving, Pete and Murr and those guys, I think it's really important that there is a URC revival, and not revival, but a real push towards silverware, knockout stages, and be there at the end in that final four or top two. But it's going to be tough with what they have, but this block of games is going to be really, really important for them.
What do you think's the bare minimum, Bernard? Is a semi-final something they should really be not expecting in an arrogant sense, but anything less than that, would that be a disappointing season?
I think it would be. I think it would be. I don't. There's no divine right to be there, but I think anything less than that,
But that has to be the standard as
that's
such.
standard. And I think you can kind of accept that given the season they've had, change of coach, more injuries, a bit of a like disappointment, obviously getting blown away to a certain extent. I think they got blown away. I know you could blame the line out, and it was a big factor in it, but I think there's a gulf in class at the moment between Munster and Bordeaux, Munster and Toulouse, Munster and Leinster. Munster Toulon potentially. The La Rochelle result was an amazing day, but La Rochelle weren't real contenders this year for Europe. They obviously have a great record over the last couple of years, but they weren't this year. It would have been a miracle if Roig could have got them back to that level, given how their form is. So, if Munster get to semi-final, which I think they will, but it's all now about next year and new coach, hopefully some new signings. Barron and Milne, it's brilliant that they're getting down there now. I think I'm very excited by Barron. Barron in particular, I think if he gets a run of games, I think he can be as good, if not better, than Gus McCarthy. And I think he'll benefit so much if he becomes number one for Munster that you'll really see how good he is. Whereas obviously Gus will be sharing the game time, you'd imagine, with Dan and Ronan. So I admire his decision to go down there. I love the fact he's getting to go down there now because he probably wasn't going to get much game time for Leinster or any, and he gets a chance hopefully to lead Munster to something a special end of season, which they're capable of, but they need everything right. They need everything right, whereas some of the other teams have just a bit more than them at the moment, and that's the stage of the cycle that Munster are at the moment.
He's tall as well, Lee Barron. So your kind of mind is instantly drawing comparisons to Dan Sheehan, as as ludicrous as that kind of is. But you just see that ranginess and the height on him, and you kind of instantly think kind of like a player that moves in the same way as
Yeah,
someone like
there's
Sheehan.
lo he has loads about him, honestly. I think they'll be really delighted with that signing in 6 months' time.
Good stuff. Right. Well, we are pretty much just about out of time. I've been just having one quick little scan on social media there to see did we miss any gigantic announcement in the last 45 minutes or so, but I think we're covered, and we can save it till next week if we do. Plenty of rugby coming up on RTE over the next few days. Wales and Ireland in the Women's Six Nations on Sunday, and a double header of URC on Saturday on RT2 and RT Player. Stormers Connacht and Munster Bulls. That's it for this part of the podcast, but I will be talking in just a couple of seconds to Hannah O'Connor on the Women's Six Nations. Now it's time to look at the Guinness Women's Six Nations. Ireland in Newport this weekend to take on Wales at Rodney Parade on Easter Sunday. Two big games, two winnable games coming up for Ireland in the next 10 days or so. Scott Beamon's side looking to get back on track after last Saturday's defeat to England. Hannah O'Connor is with me as usual for our Women's Six Nations debrief. And Hannah, Ireland 5, England 49. It might feel a bit cheap to say it after the event, but the frustrating thing about that scoreline is that the eye test would say that wasn't a 44-point game.
Yeah, hey Neil. Yeah, no, definitely. That's probably the most disappointing thing, as the second half eked on. It was really frustrating to watch the scoreboard kind of tick up, because it definitely wasn't a game that reflected that. I think the first 40 minutes really showed the difference in where Ireland have been and where they've come from to where they are now. But of course, it's about that 80-minute performance, and it was something that we flagged last week, is the power of the bench that England could bring, and that they did. Like, they just managed to kind of show their class and experience and kind of adjust their game plan after being rattled in the first 40 to kind of go back to that power game and to that game of style that they can play. And ultimately then Ireland paid the price for it in the end over the course of the 80 minutes.
Like, we were talking about it in advance of the game and wondering what sort of a team England would put out. You've been talking about how in recent years Ireland would have played them in round four, and that's when they start to prime themselves for the France game. They ultimately sent as close as, arguably their best starting 15 and best match day 23 over to Cork last weekend. It probably is a reflection on how people are viewing Ireland now.
Yeah, definitely a sign of respect. I was probably surprised myself, such as the fact that they chopped and changed so much in the first two games. Like, we talked about that, they had like 13 changes in the starting 15 over the first two games. And then, yeah, I raised an eyebrow or so when I saw how stacked they were. That's probably as full strength as they can go, bar one or two changes, which they were probably using to feel out on Saturday to see who'd be ultimately getting those starting jerseys for them over the next two games. But yeah, locked and loaded. When you look at like the likes of, former World Player of the Year Emily Scarrett can't make that team. Captain from last year Marley Packer can't make that bench. You look at the likes of Maddie Feanati, who was the player of the match there a couple of weeks ago. She's on the bench. So yeah, serious amount of caps. I don't know what they'd accumulate. You're definitely talking probably into the hundreds in terms of caps from that bench compared to, what Ireland are bringing, maybe in a little less experience off their bench. So yeah, it's very tough to compete with that. But definitely a sign of, as you said, sign of respect, and that they were willing to bring that much of a team over and not taking any chances coming to Cork.
I can tell you on the Caps here.
Yeah,
Because
do.
I took it down last week doing preparation. England's bench, just their bench, had 293
Yeah,
caps on it.
geez, yeah, tipping through.
Ireland's starting lineup had 297. So England's bench had four fewer caps than the Irish first 15 did.
Yeah.
Their starting team, England, had 719,
Yeah.
plus the 293 on the bench. So the matchday 23, in excess of 1,100 caps,
Stacked up, isn't it?
it's just staggering. And it's a long time before an Ireland can get up to that level in terms of
Yeah.
caps, and it just shows the difference, I suppose, between the teams. On one of the I suppose that the great moment of the day was Emily Costigan's try.
Yeah.
And look, I know ultimately it didn't really matter in the grand scheme of the result, but in terms of a moment down in Musgrave Park on Saturday afternoon, that was just a brilliant moment,
Class.
because you could see initially they make a little bit of a mess of the line out, and you're kind of going, oh, is that an opportunity gone away? But there's a great shot on one of the replays behind the goals where, as soon as that ball goes to ground, you see Emily breaking herself to get back over onto her wing, because she'd obviously come in field for whatever move they had planned.
Yeah.
Dan O'Brien is actually, you can see the hand movement. She's kind of gesturing for the kick as well. And
Yeah.
as soon as the ball went over, you could just see the gas that she had on, was it Jess Breach, I think, out on the, on
No,
the, on the,
Abby Dowd, even
Abby
more
Dow,
impressive.
sorry,
Yeah, really.
on the wing. Like, it was, and the roof lifted off the place when she scored. I know in the end the result didn't go the way you would have wanted, and the scoreline was a bit inflated, but what a brilliant moment.
Class. And as you said, it's those kind of moments that are, really get the crowd going and get the crowd behind you. And to strike first against England in that first half, it was, as you said, come from that kind of a fumble of a line out to regather it. But that kind of quick thinking, it reminded me of that kind of Ireland try against New Zealand when they played back down the blind side that time for Bundiaki to Jacob Stockdale. Now, not obviously the same kind of, but the same kind of pattern of playing within that channel. It was class. Yeah, just the speed of her, though, was something else. I actually met her on Sunday. No, yesterday, actually. I met her yesterday on Monday in Blackrock, and was kind of telling Amy Lee this is, and was remarking at how, serious set of wheels to show Abby Dowd, but she's as modest as ever. But I think she was tipping on it, I hope she doesn't mind me saying, like a top speed on that burn, because to see someone, absolutely burn Abby Dowd, who has serious wheels, was something else. You weren't catching her from there. But just the quick thinking, and the kick was so pinpoint perfect from Dana to have it literally dink over that top, and the trajectory of it to go end over end perfectly weighted, it was just brilliant. Yeah, so it really got the crowd going, and it was deserving of, deserving for Ireland in that sense, because they had managed to, rattle England in that first 40 minutes. They really did. They, I'd fit. We talked about it last week in terms of them putting in that defensive performance and that defensive effort that they would need across 80 minutes. But for that first 40 minutes, they certainly did. They gave different pictures. They, met them at their own game. They bullied them essentially in the contact. I think England probably, maybe a little bit of arrogance, thought that they could kind of just brute force up the jumper style rugby for the first few to break Ireland down. But the girls met them, like you see, like there was even one moment, I think, which was pretty much, showing the sign that Ireland were setting out their stall. It was like, I think Dana managed to get involved in a choke tackle, and then, it's not something you see every day from her, which, it's something that she's worked on a lot in her defensive game as well. But then I think the turnover came quickly after that. Another one was Linda Dugang out in the wide channel as well, getting a turnover. So there was a few real good moments like that, which showed Ireland were here to play and they weren't going to just roll over and take this. And it rattled England. It made England kind of rethink their game plan, which was exactly what Ireland would have wanted. And then to be able to strike blood with their own try was very much reward for what they had put in that first 40-minute shift.
And as you kind of said earlier as well, the fact that they did it first, and if they'd scored that try when they're 24-0 down, yeah, it's a nice try and all that, but it
Yeah.
doesn't have the same feel about it. It's not the same moment. And the fact that equally they didn't score it 2 minutes into the game to just kind of take a little freak 5-0
Yeah,
lead.
on the hop, like, yeah.
It was the fact that they had gone toe to toe with them for the best part of 25 minutes and then got themselves in front. And by the time half time comes around, it's 7-5. That was pretty reflective of the first 40 minutes that we'd seen.
Yeah, it was. And as you said it there, like that, it wasn't against the run of play. Like the girls struck first in that first opening minutes with that kind of foray into the England 22, and there was a calmness about them that we probably saw in the WXVs when they were playing the likes of New Zealand, and we saw them that those games are really standing to them now, those high pressure games of being able to kind of relish your opportunities in the 22 and it was in your opposition 22 against these big teams, because it was something that I probably touched upon in the previous weeks, that in years gone by that we've been guilty of kind of not being able to maintain composure when we do have time on the ball and going away from your own kind of attacking shape and attacking patterns, such as the pressure that these teams put you on under. But to see the girls manage to kind of maintain that composure, not get the rewards first out the blocks, but to keep chipping away, but showing England different pictures in their own attack as well. I thought Dana really kicked again, another game from her, where she kicked brilliantly out of hand, that she found grass when she needed to and had the back three scrambling. And if they did get hands on the ball, there's a few occasions where, you know, Ireland's speed was well matched. You see Eve Higgins and Amy Lee snaffling out Abby Dow at one stage, Jess Breach, Ellie Kildon. None of them really had much of a say in the game in that first half, which says a lot about how Ireland kind of implemented their game plan, which was brilliant.
Yeah, it really did. Moving on to the things to work on
Yeah.
for the next couple of games. It wasn't so much a case of where the game was won and lost, but more where England padded out its scoreline, but
Yeah.
scrum and line out. And for the first couple of weeks, we've spoken obviously about how much improved the Irish line out specifically is.
Yeah.
Around 95% in those opening couple of games. England get it
Yeah.
down to 72%. Ireland winning
Yeah.
just 13 out of 19 throws. And then on the scrum as well, Ireland give up six penalties across the game, having been at 100% scrum success for their opening two matches as well. When you can't secure possession off those two set pieces, it's, and I know it was going wrong at times in the first half as well, but it's no surprise that Ireland really couldn't even get out of their half in the second half.
Yeah, you know yourself, and no matter what level of game you play in, whether it's Division Four or it's international rugby, like it's so you can't live in a game. You can't expect to live in a game and build phases, build pressure when you can't win set piece. And unfortunately, like the probably the most frustrating part, you know, the weather seemed, you know, relatively okay down there. The wind kicks up a bit down in Cork, but like not compared to what the girls would have been used to and used to training in, etc. But from the scrum point of view, it's probably the most frustrating part, because over the years gone by, even knowing that there was an incredible mismatch of power, it's somewhere where the girls, where we felt over the previous years that we could really go after England, that there was areas of Botterman's game, there was areas of Sarah Byrne's game, even Maud Muir's game, where you know you felt that you could get at England and create those good pictures for the referee to kind of swing things in your favor. But unfortunately, it just wasn't to be on the day. I'm not a kind of a guru of the front row, so I won't even try to kind of comprehend what was happening there. But like you're racking up those penalties, and then the sucker punch was not only were you not getting momentum, but to have then Nivo Dowd go off on a yellow card was a double whammy, and it was the real swinger and kind of
14 points in those 10 minutes as well.
yeah, it's killer. Like so, and like it's not her fault either. Like it's a collective thing as to how that's fixed. Is like, do you make the sub before that? But then you risk losing what Nivo Dowd brings around the pitch. So it's a very difficult thing. But when you, as you said, when you can't, like when it gets your line out gets back down to 72%, you're very uneasy, you're very rattled, you know, subs come in then and not able to, you know, kind of keep the flow of it or steady the flow again, such as the pressure that you're coming under and trying to force things a little bit more. And everybody kind of loses sync with each other, like we saw it happen with Munster as well in the men's game at the weekend. It can go from being brilliant one week to just falling off the next week. But look, for them, those are the two areas that would probably frustrate them the most, because they'd be the areas that you'd figure that there's some element of control, the controllables within them. Yes, the scrum is a complete power game, and England are absolute units in that department. So you really need to be on your money to be able to compete with them at all on a technicality point of view. But yeah, look, a big week ahead coming up with Wales, we'll touch upon, I'm sure, but there has to be a massive reset for that. And you know, Wales have a big pack of their own, so I've no doubt that the girls will be able to reset and see where they can work on those two areas especially.
On the scrum stuff is true what you say, we're like talking about the yellow card and how influential it is. And I really do feel sorry sometimes for a prop like someone in Niamh Dowd's situation at the weekend, where ultimately, like, it's not like out in the middle of the pitch where you're constantly getting caught for offside or you're going off your feet. If
Yeah.
you're getting absolutely hosed in a scrum, you're kind of powerless
Can't
to
do anything.
conceding penalties. And
Yeah.
ultimately, like, I'm not saying it's a harsh yellow, obviously it makes sense that you kind of have to give the yellow, but I do
Yeah.
sometimes feel sorry for the player, where a lot of the time giving the penalty is like giving away the penalty is probably the safer option, because if you try to dig your heels in and do something stupid, either yourself or someone else is going to get badly injured. But
Yeah.
I suppose for Nieva Dowd's point of view, you just kind of have to chalk a day up to experience on something like that. She's only about 14, 15 caps into her international career. It was by far her biggest test yet as
Yeah.
an Ireland international. And it's the kind of thing where I'm sure any international prop would say, like, a day like that 5 years down the line is going to stand to you.
Yeah, and look, she's such a an eager beaver in terms of honing her craft. So like she'll learn so much from that, and she'll take so much from that. Not only her, but the pack as a whole. In both, because as you said, like it's not only down to one person. Like that whole scrum is relying on your eight people to be functioning at the same level. You obviously get the props, get the brunt of the reward and the punishment when things don't go to plan. But she'll take lots of learnings from that. And as I said, they're in good hands with Dennis Fogarty there. So they'll review and adapt and go again next week in a perfect opportunity with the next two games to come to really kind of refresh it and get it back up into those 90% where they were and where they're well capable of being. Hopefully just chalk it down to being an off day. But it's the power that England bring too. Like as I said, we've talked about that, the power that they're bringing off the bench. Arguably every single one of those players that are on England's bench will make every other Six Nations starting team. So like the power that they're bringing in terms of their physicality and in terms of their experience, it's always going to be very difficult. So unless you are on the money all the time, you're going to have a tough day at the office in terms of set piece. But yeah, they'll go again, no doubt, this weekend.
Yeah, like even I can imagine from her situation where when England have you've done 50 odd minutes up against Maud Muir and all of a sudden Sarah Byrne is coming on. It reminds me of back in the day when Andrew Porter was still a tight head and you've done your 50 minutes against Tadhg Furlong, and here comes Andrew Porter to
No
finish the
machine,
job.
like,
But
yeah, and she'd probably
on
give them, Sarah Byrne would probably give the lads a good run for her money as well.
the yeah. On the lineouts then, as we said, 13 out of 19 fell down to 72%, and at times in the second half, it wasn't even a throwing issue. There was communication stuff. People were missing jumps and lifts and everything. Would you have concerns going forward into these next two games, or again, are you kind of writing off an element of that lineout malfunction to they're going up against England? England had stolen more than half of the stolen lineouts in the Six Nations in the opening two games. You're just going up against a different beast entirely. And if you're playing against Wales and Scotland, the mistakes you make against England aren't going to be punished as badly against a Wales or Scotland.
Yeah, there's an element to it of that, but at the same time, it's probably going to disappoint the girls in that department because the lineout is an area where you kind of need to have that in the chaos. You need to have the calm where, from both callers' point of view, but everybody, like, coming off the bench, whether you're doing that everybody remains as in sync with each other as the starting eight were. So there's a little bit where England are putting you under such severe pressure that you're reverting back to, old habits or something, or you're clutching at things and rushing things a little bit, or like on your when you're supposed to spread in a line out that everybody isn't quite spreading the same distance. And all of a sudden, as you said, then it wasn't just throws. It was people missing their timing on things, and you could tell that it looked out of sync. So I think they'll review that as well, but they would rather it happen, I guess, against an England like that than, next weekend where they feel the pressure. But they've been in those high pressure matches. They had it in the WXB1s, and all the opposition that they were playing was extremely high pressure. I guess they were showing a new picture back then. Now they're showing, pictures that they've been using for a while. So you really have to be on the money to be able to execute it when teams are getting a bit wiser to you and have a bit more footage of you to go off. So I think they'll be frustrated that they couldn't, you don't mind if it's fingertip stuff and it's like the tiniest of margins, but when you're missing jumps and missing completed jumps and throws, that's when it gets a bit frustrating or more frustrating because it's an area that you really can kind of calm it down and control those bits. But yeah, I think it's a pressure environment against England that you don't probably feel against anybody else, such as the level of jumping options that they have and defensive threats. So I suppose you're at the pin of your collar in terms of putting your best picture out there. So yeah, they'll definitely be looking to dust it off and go again against a kind of a buoyed Wales team who've been going ticking along kind of in the background, not particularly fantastic, but definitely showing signs of improvement. So it would need to be something that they like the scrum. And I backed them to do it. They've done it before, and the girls will do it again to turn it around quickly and to reset the page on that as well.
Just one last point on the lineouts. Are you a lineout caller? Have you been the lineout caller in the teams you play in? And who have been the kind of standard bearers of lineout callers that you would have been involved with?
Yeah, like so I would have been the caller when I would have been playing. I'd do it at club and I would have done it at Leinster, and I would have done it within Ireland as well. I think a lot of the times when I was getting picked, if Sam wasn't there from a line-out perspective, it was me calling them. But I think that's something that they've tried, and it's for the right reasons that it can. You do want as many people to be able to call as possible for various reasons, that it gives you a different perspective on where you are in the line-out, that you're not overly reliant on being a front jumper or a back jumper, especially in international rugby. You kind of need to be able to slot in everywhere. So I think within the camp, from what I've heard from the girls, I know Dorothy Wall was was their kind of main caller at the moment, and she's taken on that and has got good experience of that over the last while. I think Fiona Chute does a bit of calling as well, and obviously on the pitch then Ruth Campbell was on for the latter stage of that match, so she would have. So it's something that they will all be put in that under that pressure cog of doing, and it's good to do it, because until you do it against an opposition as good as England, or until you do it in matches, it's different doing it in training when you know each other's calls, etc. So yeah, it's a tricky skill to do, and it only kind of comes to practice. And I suppose the standard bearers, like when I came in initially to Ireland camp, like I worked with Aoife McDermott, she called a lot of Evans as well. Nicola Friday called a lot. So you're kind of working in sync with each other as best as possible, that even if you're not calling them, you're working closely with the line out caller to be very much singing off the same hymn sheet, and kind of getting everybody their confidence through that collective buy-in.
The positives, and I think the positives far outweighed the negatives on Saturday. That first 45 minutes, in England's last four games, they had a bonus point racked up by half time, and it took them 35 minutes to break Ireland down last weekend. There was a real defiance about about the attitude that Ireland came in with that was very impressive. Where we've seen it time and time again with teams against England, where the fact that they're playing England just overawes teams, and it's happened with Ireland in the past as well. But there seemed to be a real defiance in that Irish group at the weekend, that no matter what way the game ends up, or no matter what the scoreline is at the end, that they wouldn't go out there and be bullied. And I know England pulled away with tries in the second half, and that probably comes down to a bit of the tiredness from the efforts of the first 45 minutes. But from an attitude point of view and a belief, there was a real bullishness about the way they went about it.
Yeah, and look, I mentioned it last week. It's England. At the end of the day, you are never going to need getting up, and we always tend to probably get up for it more than they do, or feel the rivalry more than they do. So I think, yeah, there was definitely, I heard Aoife Wafer talking about it in media as well, of how, you know, she'd love that kind of element of riling England up or frustrating them that first 40 minutes and getting in a bit of a push and a shove match. And I think the post-match media here in England kind of a bit of a puffing of the cheeks and realizing that they were in a bit of an arm wrestle there for the first 40 minutes. And like, that's the difference, I think, in performances over the last, even if you take the last 2 years, for example, you know, probably the year previously to last year, obviously, or when we were last over in England and Leicester, we were seven, I think 10-0 down at half time, which made it seem like it was a game, but we were surviving in that game on a defensive kind of a mass defensive holding on for dear life. Whereas this was the first time in a great number of years that you could feel that an Ireland team were going out to give England a right crack and to punch back as good as they got. So for 45 minutes, as you said, Ireland were doing that. And it's just a case now of, yes, that gap is closing. It's not perfect. We knew it wasn't going to be perfect, but it's taken all the positives from those first 45, 50 minutes and realizing that we're in this now and we're growing in the right direction. And as cliche as it sounds, that yes, those green shoots of, you know, the progress that's been made, it's not going to be an overnight thing. As you said, those vast number of caps that England have on their bench alone is going to take time for Ireland to, you know, get up to that speed and get people that experience. And it's only, like you said, the likes of the scrum, the likes of a line out, the likes of those high pressure environments against these top tier teams in the world will only come through experience. So Ireland will be taking it as a positive. They'll be looking to put again that 80 minute performance into a team like Wales, where they will feel that they are a much better team on paper than Wales, are going much better over the last number of weeks and the last kind of year or so than Wales. So it's a case of bouncing back quick enough to show that last week was a dip, and bounce back to the way they had shown the previous week against Italy to show that that's the norm. But that bar has been set now against the likes of those teams that are not the Englands and the Frances, that has to keep to be maintained. So I'm sure the girls will be looking to get back to winning ways on Sunday as well.
Yeah, I think that's what makes the next 2 weeks really, really interesting now, that there's almost, you can almost condense the England game and these two matches now into this one little block as a mini World Cup pool stage, where it's 3 weeks, one weekend after the other. Two wins ultimately is probably the target to come away with, sort of like it would be at the World Cup as well. It would, you know, you'd be qualifying off the back of that for a quarter final. But the difference between this week and last week is that this week they're going away from home to a plucky enough Wales team that have kind of shown some sparks without producing that full performance yet. But the pressure is on Ireland to deliver, and that's what's really going to be interesting to see. We got a glimpse of it obviously against Italy, where they went out, started brilliantly, and pulled off an excellent win. But the difference between a good Six Nations campaign and a kind of indifferent Six Nations campaign is going to be what happens over the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, you're only as good as your last performance. And like the last few years, everyone would have been building themselves up for, that second last week was always England. So like you had just one more week to go and kind of then drive on for another week of another top performance. But now, as you said, it's 3 big weeks together. It's England and these two matches. I think you're probably right. I think there will be an element where the girls will treat it as that kind of mini World Cup feel to it, to get a feel. But it's how the bodies recover. It's how quickly they can turn the page now, which I don't doubt that they will turn the page pretty quickly. But as you said, it's a plucky Wales side who, under Sean Lynn, who's had little to no time with them pre-tournament, they are showing signs of kind of turning a little page themselves as well, of having been kind of in the depths of it in terms of performances. And they have a lot of experience in their team. They kind of have the same heads that you'd be used to seeing out kind of the last number of years. They're getting a few players back from injury, like Kelsey Jones in the front row there as well. Gwen Crabbe is also back in the second row over the last few games. So that's experience they're getting back. So hopefully Ireland have made it through the England kind of battle relatively unscathed and have a full kind of quota to pick from, because I know they were missing Adele McMahon and Enya Breen for the England game. So look, if it gives other people opportunities, but the main thing being, as you said, if they can't turn the page and put up another performance like they did against Italy, into the same kind of emphatic nature of putting their stamp on a game away from home again, which they're well capable of doing, it also looks as because it was a flash in the pan for the Italy game. So they will be wanting to back it up and to show that last week against England was a blip for that 35 minutes or whatever that England managed to steamroll us a little bit. But yeah, I don't back that the girls will be able to turn that page. And but it'll be a tricky place to go. Wales away from home is not easy. So it'll be a really, really good challenge for the girls.
Where are the areas that Wales are most dangerous?
Like as I said, Sean Lynn is a very shrewd operator. Like he comes with good caliber there of what he's done with Gloucester over the last number of years. It's a little bit of an unknown quantity to them because you don't really know. It's like Ireland last year when you get a new coach in, you don't really know the style or what he's going to try and hone in on. I think he'll play to their strengths. They have a big pack. That brute force that they do try to power on with is, their scrum can be a weapon for them. So Ireland will need to really fix those little tweaks that are there, especially when you have a referee who look at those patterns from week one to week two. So you don't want to be painting that picture and giving the referee an easy job. So yeah, it's that unknown. They have a lot of firepower similar to Ireland in the back three, with Jazz Joyce Butcher's there, who brings a serious amount of speed. So Ireland will need to be on their game. As I said, Wales, no more than any team when they're playing at home, they are buoyed by that. I think the fact that this is in Newport as well, isn't it? So it's a new pitch, new location. It always kind of gives a fresh feel to it, no more than Ireland going between Belfast and Cork. They'll be buoyed by that. So it's just being ready for that kind of ferocity that Wales would bring, and being up to it a week after such a big match.
Final question, give us a prediction.
Yeah, I'm going to say Ireland will win by at least one score. That's what I'm going to say. I think it would be maybe a bit closer, with both teams feeling a bit battered after the week previously against France and England. But yeah, I'm going to give it to Ireland by a score.
Very good. And we'll chat to you again next week, Hannah, I'm sure.
Sure
Watch a
thing.
URC doubleheader, Stormers against Connacht and Munster Bulls on Saturday. That's from 2:30 p.m. on RT2 and RT Player. And then on Sunday, Easter Sunday, in the Guinness Women's Six Nations, Wales against Ireland from 2:40 p.m. on RTE1 and RT Player. That's RTE1 on Sunday afternoon. Follow a live blog as well on the rte.ie/sport and news app. And you can listen to Sunday Sport as well on RT Radio 1. For live commentary. We'll speak to you again soon.